We're going to read together from the Word of God, from the 12th chapter of the Revelation of St. John. The heading in the NIV translation is The Woman and the Dragon, but of course the central figure in this story is the child, the Messiah child. There are some strange images here. Well, they're certainly strange down Killamont Way. I don't know what it's like in Mulgai, but we don't have many dragons. We don't have dragons that sweep stars out of the sky. We don't have many of the other images that appear in this reading. And we don't often think in these terms. But it is pretty clear what we're being told. Despite the unusual vocabulary, despite the unfamiliar pictures. So bear with me as we read, and we'll talk a little bit more about what these images, or what God might be trying to tell us through these images. Revelation chapter 12. A great sign appeared in heaven. A woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and 7 crowns on its heads. Its tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth so that it might devour her child the moment he was born. She gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter. And her child was snatched up to God and to his throne. The woman fled into the wilderness, to a place prepared for her by God, where she might be taken care of for 1260 days. Then war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back. But he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil, or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. He was hurled to the earth, and his angels with him. Then, says John, I heard a loud voice in heaven say, Now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Messiah. For the accuser of our brothers and sisters, who accuses them before our God day and night, has been hurled down. They triumphed over him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. They did not love their lives so much as to shrink from death. Therefore, rejoice, you heavens, and you who dwell in them. But woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has gone down to you. He is filled with fury because he knows that his time is short. When the dragon saw that he'd been hurled to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. The woman was given the two wings of a great eagle so that she might fly to the place prepared for her in the wilderness, where she would be taken care of for a time, times and half a time, out of the serpent's reach. Then from his mouth the serpent spewed water like a river to overtake the woman and sweep her away with the torrent. But the earth helped the woman by opening its mouth and swallowing the river that the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. And then the dragon was enraged at the woman and went off to wage war against the rest of her offspring, those who keep God's commands and hold fast their testimony about Jesus. Amen. And may God bless us with a deeper, clearer understanding of this, his living word. Here's a headline from a newspaper which I love to hate, and yet it's such a rich source of material for sermons. I speak, of course, of the Daily Mail. This was one of their headlines: "Killjoy Pope crushes Christmas nativity traditions. New Jesus book reveals there were no donkeys beside the crib, no lowing oxen, and definitely no carols." Well, poor old Pope Benedict, once again, he's getting bashed in the press. But actually, it's old news, as old as the Gospels themselves. The fact that journalists, many, most of whom, have no real interest at all in the story of Christmas, the fact that they are outraged that someone might be debunking myth, someone even as eminent as the Pope himself, shows the need that we have for man-made traditions. We, particularly in the Reformed Church, we have a bit of a downer on the Pharisees, the religious leaders who opposed Jesus and the early church. At least some of them did. We like to point up their foolishness in preferring their own man-made traditions over the true will of God. But actually we're no different. We have our own man-made traditions in almost everything that we do. This pulpit itself is a man-made tradition, perhaps a good one, but nevertheless, that's what it is. But perhaps nowhere else has there been a greater outgrowth of man-made traditions that threaten to choke the truth of the birth of Christ. Man-made traditions inevitably distort God's truth. And at Christmas, we see lots and lots of them. We focus upon the baby, not surprisingly, although of course the Gospels have almost nothing to say about the birth itself. I love that little line in Away in a Manger, "No crying he makes." In the Reformed faith, we talk about the full humanity of Jesus. It is highly unlikely that he did not cry. In fact, if he did not cry, then he would not have been a human baby. But we love to sing it. And we put in little animals. The cuter, the better. That was the busiest manger ever. Amazingly, there was space to have a birth. And we've added in my time, and I've done it myself, little mice peering from under the straw. Little spiders hanging from the roof, all telling the story. It's there to comfort us. It's there to give us reassurance. It adds the coo factor. But it also diffuses the explosive power of the story. When God was born in the stable, He came to blow the devil away. And that's why tonight, Advent Sunday, we go to the last book in the Bible for the event which opens the New Testament. The Revelation of St. John is not traditionally regarded as the account of record of the birth of Jesus Christ. We've read chapter 12, and we certainly have not found the detailed account of the incarnation which we found in Matthew or Luke or even in the Gospel of John. However, those Gospel accounts, Matthew, Luke, John, offer descriptions of the events surrounding the birth of Jesus. As I say, very little about the birth itself. They offer different accounts from different perspectives. And that's what we find in Revelation chapter 12. A different, perhaps unfamiliar, but nevertheless legitimate perspective on the birth of Jesus. I go further and hazard the assertion that the account in Revelation adds a crucial dimension to our understanding, which we would be very unwise to ignore. My own folk in Killermouth have heard over the 9 Christmases that I've been with them, they've heard me plead, cajole, that Jesus be allowed to grow up. That He be permitted to escape the nappies and the manger. That He can't always remain as the little baby who doesn't cry. We remind ourselves, if our understanding of Christmas is healthy at all, we remind ourselves that over the manger looms the shadow of the cross. But equally, we understand that that shadow, the shadow of the cross, is thrown by the bright new dawn of the resurrection, which glows behind it. And even beyond the resurrection is the truth that Jesus ascended into heaven, where He both reigns and intercedes for us, His sisters and brothers. We celebrate the birth of Jesus because it was the beginning. We celebrate the birth of Jesus because it was a tangible, in the flesh, expression of God's love for us and the perfection of His plan to save us. And that is what Revelation 12 so brilliantly reminds us. We read a story with 3 characters. The least mentioned, but the central character, is the child. There is no doubt that the child is Jesus, the Son of God, the Messiah. The red dragon, well, we're told he's the devil, Satan, the evil one. If you've anything like me, you're slightly nervous. It's bad enough trying to convince people that there is a devil who isn't a cartoon Satan. Trying to describe him as a red dragon whose tail sweeps a third of the stars out of the sky, that seems like quite a challenge. And yet, speaking for myself, that is wrong. In our postmodern world, the rational certainties which are preached by Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and others, they are paid lip service to, in a world, certainly a Western world, that rejoices in the Lord of the Rings, that is waiting eagerly for the Hobbit. My friends, these images have been given to us by God, because however we may fool or delude ourselves, He knows what they mean, what they convey, and that we do really understand them. So let's not be embarrassed by this story. And then there is the mother. Now, there's a little bit of argument, in the nicest possible way, about what the mother, who the mother represents. Is it Mary? Possibly. Most scholars, however, see the mother as probably being Israel, the nation of Israel, 12 stars, 12 tribes, the sun and the moon. You remember the story of Joseph and his dream? God is using the nation of Israel, the people of Israel, the people of God, His own people, His chosen people, to bring His Son into the world. And you know that Jesus traced His ancestry through the bloodlines of Israel. He's a descendant of the Jewish King David, the tribe of Judah, all the way back to Israel's forefathers, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Let's go back to that child. As I say, there's little doubt this is a reference to Jesus Christ, God's Son. The book of Revelation is rich with wonderful descriptive phrases for Jesus. He's called the beginning and the end, the Alpha and the Omega. He's the Lamb who was slain for the world's sins, conquering King, a lion, others too. And that's because the revelation of St. John is first and foremost a revelation about Jesus. We get the stories of Jesus in the Gospels. But Revelation, along with the letters of Paul and others, and of course the Old Testament itself, they add explanation. They add color. They flesh out the meager bones of the gospel accounts. God has given them to us so that we might understand better and trust more deeply. So Revelation is a revelation of Christ's true character. And we can be certain the child is the Messiah Jesus. The birth of a child is the birth of the Messiah Jesus. The birth which we are focusing on celebrating in a few weeks' time. And here Jesus is presented in two ways. Firstly, as a king. The king who is destined to rule over the nations with a rod of iron. Look at Psalm 2:9 and you'll see similar words used there. But equally, the word rule has the image of the leadership of a shepherd. And Jesus is presented as the true shepherd of the nations, the true guide and leader, who can lead the nations to peace and freedom. A shepherd who cares for his sheep, every single one of them. A shepherd who will give his life for even the puniest lamb or the most worn out ewe. A shepherd who leads by guiding and loving and caring rather than by forcing. And yet he leads with this rod of iron. This shepherd is also a king with authority and power and right. And the rod of iron is balanced against the imagery of the shepherd, the king, the shepherd. They don't cancel each other out. They're part of this rich image that we are given of Jesus as tender and yet firm and powerful, caring and just. The one who will gather us up in his arms and yet will fight off the most ferocious wolf unmercifully. And so we're given this picture of the child who will rule the nations with the rod of iron. But waiting for this child is the dragon, the red dragon, who stands, mouth agape, teeth glistening, hot breath searing, the mother giving birth to the child, waiting to devour her beloved offspring. But that is not what will happen. That is not what did happen. In His sovereignty, in His power, God snatches up His Son and into heaven, and He is beside the throne. What this image does is telescope the life of Jesus into just a few words. The hundreds, thousands of words of the gospel are reduced to a short sentence. All that we need to know, that this baby is born into the most terrible danger. Remember Herod. He will live his life under threat. He will never be entirely safe. And yet he will be safe until the moment, until the time which he and his father have chosen for him to die, the way that they have chosen for him to die, the place and the reason. And that death is not a defeat. It has a purpose. It is expected. It is part of the plan. And so it almost needs not to be mentioned in this context. For the Son rises again and He ascends into heaven. Remember John's words. This is John writing on Patmos. He's been separated from his people. He's in exile. He is alone. He is disorientated. He has only his faith in God, and God responds to him with these wonderful, powerful images. So unsettling and yet so reassuring. And John says, "Now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of His Messiah." That is a statement of certainty, of assurance. The dragon may be red. The dragon may be mighty. His tail may be so powerful as to sweep a third of the stars from the sky. But he cannot have the Son of God, the Messiah. For the Messiah has been born for a purpose and for a reason. And by the blood of that Lamb, the people of God will triumph over the devil, the evil one. And we're told of the great battle in the heavens, inaugurated by the birth of Christ, triggered by the birth of the Messiah, the great battle which the dragon loses. He is hurled to the ground, and he is filled with fury because he knows that his time is short. You know the recent history. Hitler after Stalingrad, there was no prospect of ever winning against the combined Allied armies. Saddam Hussein and his forces fought on long after they had been defeated. And so it is with the evil one. He is defeated. He cannot win, and yet he fights on with growing desperation. Desperation that fuels viciousness, that makes him even more dangerous. He is enraged at the people of God, at the woman, and he wages war against the rest of her offspring, those who keep God's commands and hold fast to their testimony about Jesus. That is true. There is evil in this world, and we know that. We see it in the way that we deal with one another, how even the kindest, most generous, most loving person is capable of terrible silences. Desperate stinginess with time and love and money and resources. We see it in ourselves. We see it in our world. How else can the beauty of creation be so sullied by what we describe as natural disasters? I know not everyone would agree with that, but I'm more and more convinced that when we see earthquakes and volcanoes and terrible storms, this is the tail of the red dragon sweeping across the face of the earth. What about the illnesses that strike us, that drag us physically down, that threaten our spirits? This is the terrible bite of the dragon. The war continues. Devil is defeated, but he will not recognize it. He still pursues us. My friends, the baby was born not to sell Christmas cards, not to provide a wonderful story for our children, not to make us feel warm and fuzzy as we do when we see any human child. Jesus, the baby, was born as a declaration of total war against the evil one, because nothing less than total war will defeat evil. And that, my friends, is why we celebrate. Christmas time is a time for awe and wonder and, yes, fear in the true sense of the word, as we stand before a cosmic mystery. It is a time of rejoicing because we know that the battle has been won. You've probably been reading, perhaps even in my favorite newspaper, about a young man called Angus T. Jones. Frankly, I'd never heard of him until a few days ago, but he apparently plays a character called Jake Harper in a sitcom, 2 and a Half Men. Must be the only sitcom I haven't seen. I'm a great fan of sitcoms. But this Angus T. Jones, I think he's in his early 20s now. He's been maybe 10 years playing child and teenager in this sitcom. Apparently he's paid about $10 million a year. So he's a very wealthy young man. Very famous, very powerful for someone of his age. But his real power are the words that he speaks as a disciple of Jesus Christ. In the last year, he has been converted, whatever that truly means. He has become a disciple of Jesus. He talks very movingly about his encounter with the living Christ. He can tell us to the day, almost to the hour, when he decided, he chose Christ. He says that he had a big wake-up call, that God was speaking to him and saying, the way that your life is set up now and the way you're living and planning to continue on living, smoking weed and doing acid, it's not going to get you what you want. God woke him up. He said, there were so many other things I could have steered off into that could have made me just another statistic. And I know enough about 2 and a Half Men to know that its former star was one Charlie Sheen, who has a good man who's bent on destroying his life and doing so in the full glare of publicity. Angus T. Jones has been asked about the impact of his faith upon his work, because he's still contracted to appear for another year in 2.5 men. And he says, it's a really interesting experience. I know that I'm there for a reason, but at the same time, I have this strange twist of being a hypocrite, a paid hypocrite. That's the way I've been looking at it lately. Even though it's my job to be an actor, I have given my life to God. I'm very comfortable and firm in that. But I still have to be on this show. It's a number one comedy, but it's very inappropriate. And the themes are very inappropriate. I have to be this person I am not. I have to be this person I am not. Well, I don't know what the penalty clause in his contract is. But Angus T. Jones doesn't have to be the person he is not. He is released. He is free. The battle for his salvation is won. Jesus Christ is born. None of us need to be the people that we are not. That is the reason why we celebrate Christmas. And we all have to decide. Every single one of us, whether we're going to continue to be the people that we are not, doing what is inappropriate, living in ways that are very inappropriate. We have to decide, and in many ways a litmus test of our decision is the way that we treat Christmas. I am not suggesting we do not stuff ourselves full of turkey or mince pies or Christmas pudding, because I love them all. Of course there should be presents and parties. But how do we see that baby? How do we understand his birth? I have to be this person I am not. That is a counsel of despair. That flies in the face of the birth of Jesus Christ. Let us celebrate, my friends. And let us be the people whom God has created us to be.